My name's Gary. I don't know if these two guys, I know some of you. I'm here in anthropology and at the Committee on Globalization.
Kristen Ross, Compline at NYU.
Jason, I study at philosophy and education at Teachers College, and particularly temporality in education. I also do work with Occupy University.
Cooper Francis, I just finished an MA at Kingston.
Massimiliano Tomba, I teach in Padova, University of Padova, and I'm in New York, I'm visiting New York.
Well, usually in these things, you know, our idea has been to try to create events where we don't just have someone come and give a talk and disappear and do multiple events and have a chance to really kind of think together about some of the issues. I had more comments written out, but we're a very small group here, so this could be a very informal conversation. Usually, you know, me and the visitor start talking for a while, and then other people can jump in, but we should just, you know, we're just 5, 3, 4, 6 people, we should just talk together, and rather than just, you know, grilling and questioning Peter, we can maybe think together about some of the issues. Are you here?
Just, I have to go.
Oh, okay.
I have to go. Okay.
So, let's see. You guys who weren't here, we had a very lively conversation yesterday about the relationship between kind of temporal structures, this shifting spatiotemporal matrix under globalization, as Peter described it, and the possibility of politics today, last night, and yesterday. We discussed two of his papers on the contemporary as opposed to the modern. And I guess one way in, I thought, was to kind of come back to this question of the contemporary. So I had a bunch of questions here. I'm going to just start with one question that might start us off. In our seminar, we have a faculty seminar here. Not many people are present for the faculty seminar. We've been very interested in, we started this semester with Casella on the plurality of historical temporality. We then talked about Bloch and Red Bloch and Benjamin, where we talked about the plurality of times. Then we kind of talked a little bit about spectrality and a kind of different Derridean take and orientation and approach to this idea of plural times. And you kind of give us this nice notion of modernity versus the contemporary, right, in your papers. And you talk about the contemporary in terms of a co-presence of different social times. I can't even find. And I guess one of the things that we've been struggling with as a group that maybe you can help us with is that this kind of idea of a plurality of times coexisting, co-present, the kind of non-contemporaneity of the contemporaneous, the non-synchronous of the synchronous, all of these kinds of really rich and enticing formulations are also very opaque and difficult to grasp. So one thing I thought you could help us with is to think about, to kind of say a little bit more about what you actually mean by different times, what you mean by temporal structure. At some points, it seems like it's a matter of different social times coming together in a living present, as you say. At other times, it seems to be more about social differences coming together at a single time. So I guess this question, you know, the question very simply is what you mean and what we mean by different times. Like Max yesterday asked a question where he was talking, referring, I guess, to Kosellick's idea of all these layers of different social practices and processes that have different tempos, different speeds, different, you know, durations. So I guess, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that Bloch talks about at any given moment there are people who are rooted in different forms of life, as if they lived in different historical epochs, which is one kind of way of thinking about this plurality. Benjamin seems to talk about the kind of transgenerational ways, or even you mentioned Freud last night, or psychoanalysis, the transgenerational ways in which people from different epochs appear to be contemporary, or addressed as contemporaries, which is a slightly different take. And then there's this Kosellickian idea of layers of time and different strata of kind of this of social life that are operating according to different tempos and rhythms. So maybe we can start there with you helping us, certainly helping me, thinking about what you mean by contemporaneity and the contemporary as this co-presence coming together of, in a disjunctive but unified way, of these different social times as a in a lived present, as a lived present.
I mean, I think the idea is that those previous versions, particularly the Blog, but also something in cultural theory, you know, something like the Raymond Williams stuff about residual, dominant, emergent, alternative, you know, that way of, all of those ways of schematizing different historical layers are all, in a way, still modifications of a developmentalist problematic. And in a way, you know, Bloch is dialecticizing the developmentalist problematic, so he's theoretically criticizing and making it more theoretically complicated, but it's still part of a developmentalist problematic.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do you think? Well, how do you think the articulation of different temporalities historically, but at the level of the global whole, in a non-developmentalist way? In other words, without imposing a developmentalist problematic at the level of the whole, such that you can then produce these layers which are developmentalist. Emergent dominant residual is clearly, you know, a kind of form of progressivism. The way partly what I'm doing is taking the, you know, the Fabian critique of the developmentalist problematic in anthropology, yeah, which is based around this notion of the coeval character of the encounter. So that it, but in what happens in Fabian is that the Johannes Fabian, the book The Time,
Socialist. Okay.
Time
yes.
of the Other, I think it's
called. Yeah, Time and the Other.
Time
yeah.
and the Other, yeah. In order to do that, he grounds everything in a kind of completely flat notion of the coeval, you know, which is, if you like, the common, blank, empty space in which these temporalities associated with different practices from different historical, but primarily from different spatial dimensions come, you know, and thinks the that relation in terms of the encounter. Yeah. So there's a kind of, you know, there's that, if you like, alternative anthropological problematic. But the problem with that is that in a way, the notion of the coeval is functioning there to unify this temporal whole in a kind of neutral, empty way, yeah. In a way which at the level of historical time actually just looks like a version of homogeneous empty time. So it looks like he's got the same kind of
flat
space,
one-dimensional.
But in order to get rid of the developmentalist problematic, he's actually dehistoricizing it so that all the relations are spatial because of the emphasis on the fact that anything which is coeval is in the same time. And therefore, you can't make historical distinctions between coeval practices. Right? So, in a way, it's an anthropological critique of historical time itself. Right? In other words, it's such a strong critique of the developmentalist problematic that it eliminates the notion of historical time in a way. So the idea is to think, well, instead of projecting in this kind of implicitly quasi-transcendental way, a sort of emptying way, coeval time as the empty space and then have the determinate social times, is to try to think the time of the whole as the product, as if you like, the product of the totality of relations between the differential times. Right? So that there is no blank time that they share. They share a time which is produced by the relation between their differential times. And it's not a kind of aggregative thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a production.
I love that that focus on historical specificity, and I want to come around to that, but I think first I'm asking an even more basic question. Because I don't want to take this, it's so, when you talk about time, it gets so slippery. When we talk about time, it gets so slippery, so I don't want to take anything for granted. So I think the first question I'm asking in a much more basic way is what you mean, we mean by different social times. Are they different, different kinds of practices associated with different social formations that have different temporal dimensions? Is it different experiences of, like, what the unit time here, or what you call temporal structure in your different writings, what distinguishes one time from another time?
Firstly, it's not a time. Time is like a misleading shorthand.
Sure.
Because what they are temporal structures.
Okay.
So if you think that all time, which we're using, in terms of a model of temporalization, in terms of the production of structures, different ways of relating past, present, and future, which is, if you like, a production of different forms of temporal difference, so that all social practices, if you like, produce their own temporalizations, their own way
of figuring past, present,
of figuring the relation between past, present, and future. So that there's no time as a container here of any kind.
Sure.
But at the level of social and historical time, there's time as a kind of a container at the level of cosmological time. But that's a more complicated mediation. You know, the time that, you know, that kills you. that sort of time.
Okay, so I'm
but
still
the
wondering
it doesn't follow, for example,
about how we recognize the difference between a different one time and another, one temporal structure and another temporal structure. Is it that of agricultural rhythms and seasons versus debt and mortgages? Is it...
That would be one example.
Lived experience?
That would be one example, yeah. I mean, they're connected to lived experience, but the point is that the lived experiences of the structures...
The fraction of the practices.
Are not necessarily, like, the best indication of those structures themselves. In other words, you need to analytically reconstruct the conceptual structure of the temporal differences in a way that's related to the experiences, but it's not necessarily... In other words, they're not necessarily lived phenomenologically without illusion about them.
Not in a transparent way. Yeah.
Or immediate way. So they have to be reflected on.
Yeah, they have to be reflected on. I mean, the point is, this goes back to what we were saying about Benjamin yesterday. Benjamin's project is, if you like, to reflectively transform historical experience, right? But in a way, Benjamin's project is too strong, because Benjamin wants to take what is, a metaphysically very large and difficult concept of historical experience and give an account whereby everybody could have that experience. Right? So the now time, in a way, is too metaphysically invested. You have to have the experience of history as a whole, in this instantaneous way. So that what I wanted to do was to separate out this notion of historical temporalizations, which is looking at the historical aspects of these social temporalizations, from temporalizations of history in the collective singular, which is, if you like, a reflective and constructive production of the time of the whole, which people live in mediated ways, but only via the systems of relation which connect their practices to the whole.
But almost by definition, they could never be known.
They could never be experienced.
They could be known.
Well, they could be analytically reconstructed in various ways. It depends what your concept of knowledge is.
Yeah.
I have another...
They could be thought.
Kind of...
But, I mean, Benjamin, in a way, is following Kant, and then there's just... Kant has a strong distinction between knowledge and thinking. So he's not going to allow thinking to be a form of knowledge. Okay. In order to get over that, Benjamin has to expand the concept of knowledge so that all this stuff can count as knowledge.
Let me jump to the historical specificity issue for a second, because there seem to be two kinds of historical specificity you're talking about, and I like both of them, but I want to kind of clarify. One is kind of, in a more general sense, getting away from, let's say, Fabian's, or that moves, that gesture's dehistoricizing kind of implication, and saying, look, you know, the fractured and unified whole has to do with the aggregate of all these different social practices, and the way you just described the historical specificity of your idea of contemporaneity, which makes perfect sense to me, and I'm with. And another is a stronger claim, which is related, but slightly different, which is also quite interesting, that you've made in a couple of the papers we've read and in the talk last night, which is that there's something about the temporal structures at this, in this historical present, linked to globalization, that kind of gives substance, let's say, to the fiction of contemporaneity. Like, so there's some, so in other words, partly I'm reading your stuff and thinking along with you, like, oh, this is a useful way to think about kind of temporal dynamics in any time and place. And at other moments, you're making a stronger claim, like there's something happening at this, in this historical present, linked to the denationalization of capital markets, as you said yesterday, linked to globalization, linked to the kind of big shifts in temporal, you know, experience and the matrix, that is producing this kind of co-presentness, contemporaneity now. And I just wonder if you could say a little bit about, because both seem very plausible to me.
But there's two, I think there's two separate issues. One is to do with historicization, you know, because, and, you know, this is something in a way that, you know, it begins in the temporality of modernity, because the thing that's paradoxical about the temporality of modernity is that it's dehistoricizing, okay? because it's a kind of abstract temporal formalism. I mean, this logic of the new is an abstract temporal formalism, so it's just kind of formal temporal machine. Yeah. So it's dehistoricizing. But the point is that dehistoricizing logic is itself a historical form. Yeah. So, although if you like, you can have like an ideological critique of modernity for dehistoricized conception of time, you need to recognize that it is a historical form. So the way to historicize modernity is not to, if you like, say, well, there's something illusory about the abstract temporal formalism, is to realize, if you like, what are the historical conditions of the abstract temporal formalism. So that, I mean, this relates to the debate, you know, in Marxism about the relation between historical and systematic dialectic. People who think there's a distinction between historical and systematic dialectic think capital is a systematic dialectic, but then you have to add the history, so you have the empirical bits. So history is empirical and the systematic dialectic is the logical. But that's a, on this model, that's a fundamental mistake, because the systematic dialectic is carrying the historicity of the formalism. The formalism is the historical form. Yeah. What capital as a historical form does is impose a dehistoricizing temporality. Yeah. So that is a historical temporality, that dehistoricized form. So you can't, if you like, so that, you know, I completely oppose this opposition of historical and systematic dialectic.
But
that's the answer to the authoritarian charge I gave yesterday.
Yeah, okay.
Which
but
is a really good one.
Good.
A really good answer to that, I think.
Because I didn't understand the charge. So.
No, because I think that's right. I think that's right, that this formal is not really outside of history, but precisely the kind of structure of temporality that capital produces.
But what's peculiar about the contemporary in relation to that is two things.
That's
on the one hand, it seems to be more dehistoricizing. I mean, there's a version, there's a tendency within that, within the temporality, within, if you like, the interpretation and the experience of the temporality, to be more dehistoricizing because of the emphasis on presence, on the co-presence of different times, right? Which, if you like, cuts off this dynamic relation to the future, which is part of the historical side of the formalism of the modern. You know, which we mentioned this yesterday in the seminar, which is, if you like, you know, a version of what Fred Jameson's going on about in the postmodernism book about the eternal present of the postmodern. I mean, that's in a way, people would now say that's the eternal present of the contemporary postmodern book.
Right.
Or whatever. So there is that tendency, but on the other hand, as a temporal form at the level of the whole, this is the problem by the original problem. At the level of the whole, it's much more dynamic, because it's made up of a much more dynamically disjunctive multiplicity of different times, because it's spatially distributed across the whole, right? So it's embracing relations between them all, but it's embracing those relations between these more radically disjunctive multiplicities of time come into existence on the basis of an abstract temporal logic, which is capital, which is expanded reproduction. So if you like, there's the imposition of, if you like, a unifying abstract temporal logic at the level of capital, but the consequence of the production of the relations of capital is that these other temporalities come into relations with each other, relations with each other.
So instead of having the encounters with these others outside in some other, that are really
in
some other time, feudal or whatever, it's all inside.
It's all inside, yeah. So this is why I refer to the
Fabian.
It's what you refer to as synchronization that I don't like, because I don't like this.
But that's the kind of thing you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Which is articulating the time.
But you're also suggesting there was something about this. You're right, globalization in the last 25 years.
Yeah, because that's the point at which capital starts to, if you like, produce these interconnections at the level of the whole.
Right.
But it's also the level at which, and this is, I think, what to me would help, it's also the level not only at which objectively this happens, but subjectively it happens too.
Yeah, subjectively.
And therefore, post-colonialism is very important, and that there's a kind of realization by the West that it isn't in this advanced developmental stage, that there's, in other words, there is something that happens. I guess, because I have to go, but let me something about
times.
The way it then just becomes an objective analysis.
But why does it just become an objective
analysis?
Well,
because, all right, I'm going to drop this little bomb and then leave. But that it becomes, it becomes then this objective analysis of capital, after which we as subjects are just kind of like...
No, the objective analysis of capital, that's what, if you like, that's the condition which establishes the terrain for...
But can there be a dialectic which is also
It's not...
But the subjective, in other words, you as a philosopher, I as a philosopher, Western philosophers, particularly Western philosophers, who have lived the reality of the developmental theory of history, find ourselves questioning our own principles. And that's the part I'm somehow missing.
But this is a critique of development. I mean, the question, after the Fabian, because in a way, a lot of my thinking about this began with the Fabian. It's a question of, how to rehistoricize Fabian's critique of developmentalism.
Without losing, holding on to the critique,
but rehistoricizing. But to that point, I think when... Using my concept of synchronization, when capital tries to synchronize different temporalities, capital produces at the same time counter-temporalities. And that means synchronization is not the unifying process of different temporalities. This is the
temporal capital. It's not standardization.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, exactly because of the process of synchronization, it produces new counter-temporalities, which...
But the question.
And then you have the subjects. Otherwise, you have just the structure
I agree at one level, but there's two problems here. One is, capital is the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not a structure without a subject. It is the subject of the process, depending on your concept of subject, which is why we've been arguing about it.
Yeah.
Subject is. But firstly, capital is the subject. And secondly, the difficult thing is, on your account of the production of counter-temporalities, which I agree with, but the problem is, in a sense, politically, it's too dialectical for you. Because it's dialectical production of counter-temporalities, if you like, embraces the counter-temporality into the developmental logic of capital. So you get into the position, so in other words, so you've completely internalized your opposition as in reaction to capital. So you get into the position that Tronti got into in the 70s, of working out that actually the whole point of the workers' movement was to increase the productivity of capital.
Yeah.
Right. That the historical function of workers' organisation was to increase productivity. Right. But, you know, and that follows, obviously, from the fact, you know, that within this pure capital schema, pure capital plan we were talking about, you know, labour simply appears as variable capital. So in a way, of course, that alternative is dialectically embraced within it, because in terms of the theory, you know, labour is itself capital.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So you have to have a sense of, I don't say alternative, but other temporalities that enter into a relation with capital that are not merely its dialectical other or reactive to it.
But I think you
don't have an opposition, but also one that is not a pure outside.
Yeah, right?
Because there is no pure outside to this process. So that.
Well, something like I agree with you, but I think therefore you have a dominant temporality in Marx analysis.
Yeah.
You have the dominant temporality of the valorization process. And therefore you have, as a reaction, the dominant counter-temporality of the class struggle, which is not a struggle in order to have a more wage. It's not a struggle inside the wage-capital relationship, but it's a struggle for breaking the wage capital relationship.
Yeah, but it's the struggle and then, for breaking but, it, which...
But we have a point with Marx. That means, and we have a point in the question. Is there a dominant temporality and therefore a dominant counter-temporality from which point of view we can consider other counter-temporalities? Yeah. Otherwise, you are right. You have...
But the point is that, in a way, it's shorthand to say there's a dominant temporality, which is the temporality of capital, because, as you say, capital is not one temporality here. It's really, it's an incredibly complicated articulation of different temporalities. Temporality of production, temporality of circulation, temporality of, you know, credit, temporality of, you know, banking. You know, it's lots of temporality. So it's not like there's, if you like, one temporality of capital. I mean, there's one... If you like, systemic logic to the articulation of the temporalities, but it's precisely because of, if you like, the multiple temporalities internal to capital that capital is constituted by periodic crisis, because periodic crisis is periodic disjunctions in the articulation of the temporalities that are internal to capital. And that's what crisis is, and that's why it's imminent to capital, because of the multiplicity of temporalities. So you can say, if you like, that something like the logic of capital is socially dominant in some way, but you can't say that there's one temporality that is, because capital is this incredibly complicated system, which is why you need the concept of synchronization to wish them all into one.
Yeah.
Are those different temporalities qualitatively different, though? I mean, they share a certain kind of abstracting logic that distinguishes them from different kinds of concrete forms of time that something like Benjamin talks about.
Yeah, I think there are I think there are qualitatively different temporalities that are equally constitutive
within capital
for the reproduction of the value form. Yeah, definitely.
But now you have the question: what is your criterion in order to differentiate different temporalities or times? You need a criterion. Otherwise, you have just the surface of equal in different temporalities, and you can choose whatever you want. You have just temporalities. But if you want to differentiate qualitatively the temporalities, the times, need a criterion.
But I mean, if you follow, you don't need a criterion. You need to like construct the multiplicity of qualitatively different temporalities. You don't. It's not like it's not a criterial issue, right? It's not. It's a constructive issue. So that, I mean, if you think about, this is your subject. You wrote a book on this, right?
Yes.
If you think about the different temporal, from what I would call, let's say, the different temporalities in Capital, the book.
Yeah.
Right? There are different times in the book, the different places in the systematic logic of the book. Production, circulation, reproduction of the whole. You get different temporalities. So the temporality of production, the temporality of circulation, the temporality of banking and credit in the three volumes are qualitatively distinct temporalities.
I mean, that's kind of my first question. Like, what we mean by those differences. Because, I mean, they're different speeds, and there are different kind of scales to them in terms of, like, what marks the beginning and end of, like, a cycle, something like that. But are... It's truly a question.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a perplexing question of are they different temporalities?
I think they are, because they're...
Production, circulation, credit.
I think they are, because they're... If you derive temporalities from the temporal structure of the social practices based on, if you like, different ways of constructing temporal differentiation itself, then I think that...
So you're saying each one of these aspects of capitalism, for example, figures or presupposes a different relationship between past, present, and future? If it's not just speed, or if it's not just scale, I guess we're back to stuck on criteria.
Economists would want to level them all quantitatively. Would want to be able to quantitatively level them, but I don't. That may give them satisfaction, but I don't know if it would give them much analytical insight. But it's basically because the social logic of each of the practices is different.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, each of the practices in terms of production, circulation, and reproduction of at the level of the whole in relation to credit and banking, they have a different social logic. So they're...
It's all about the valorization of value, right?
Yeah, but in terms of the history of capitalism also, they become radically transformed, because in different phases of the history of capitalism, valorization has, as a result of responses to different kinds of crises, has focused on one or, on different parts of the system. So then, in a way, ironically, in the history of capitalism, it looks as if, although I want to make this as a claim, but, as if you can say, well, there was a phase in capitalism where the production of surplus was the issue. Struggle around, increasing the surplus was the issue. You can take an account of that. There's a phase in which capital, responded to crises about the ability to increase the surplus by, increasing the speed of circulation. So in other words, you speed up the realization of value in response to the inability to create more, etc. And then there's the phase, if you like, of finance capital, where the stuff it's the reproduction at the level of the whole. Where the mechanisms for reproducing the whole become independent forms of valorization, so that they separate themselves from their reproductive function. So finance capital is no longer the credit system which allows for the average rate of profit to impose itself on productive capital, but is actually a form, of
itself.
Becomes, etc. So you can write the history of capital in those kind of classical ways. But if you then rewrite it from the standpoint of the temporality of each of the practices. See, I don't think that's the problem. I don't think anybody's really done it properly yet, but I don't see a kind of, I think it's a technical and a kind of, it's a piece of work to be done, but I don't think that there is an in principle philosophical issue about doing that. The question really is all to do with what's the relation of these temporalities to other social temporalities. That's the political question.
But underneath that is the question of what do we mean by a social temper? I mean, where the line between one is and the other. So I don't think it's just a technical issue. Yeah. I mean, I think it goes to the heart of this interesting thing of contemporaneity as a co-presence of multiple temporalities and to know what that multiplicity consists of. I'm sorry.
Can we come back to Fabian a little bit? Because one of the things he says in the idea of coevalness is that coevalness is something that's created.
By the encounter.
Right, by the encounter. And so, I guess, in light of the discussion that flowed, that came after you brought up Fabian, I guess one question would be, first, what's the nature of this creation of co-presence? I mean, I think this is kind of a difficult idea to imagine that we somehow, and I think he's borrowing from phenomenology and Alfred Schutz, when he brings up this idea that you create time together with the other, and that's the ground for genuine communication.
I mean, that's just a socialization of the cell consciousness.
So I guess the one question would be that, is our current, or even past, modes of capitalism, do they prevent this type of creation of co-presence?
I don't like co-presence. I think co-presence is... It's for me the ideological representation of co-evilness.
So
there's a problem in the other. I have a problem with the concept of presence, right?
Okay.
I mean, if you think, one of the first interesting, I was looking back to try and recover the history here. One of the few 20th century philosophical discussions of contemporaneity as a time form is actually in Gadamer's Truth and Method, in his reading of Kierkegaard, of the concept of contemporary Kierkegaard, in which, but what's interesting, because Gadamer is, so conservative, I mean, philosophically, is that he presents Kierkegaard wholly as a theory of co-presence and presence, obviously in the Heideggerian mode. And I think that's a notion of the contemporary. It's that notion of the contemporary which got into the kind of Jamesonian notion of the eternal presence and stuff, but as an ideological form. But I think Fabian is trying to think the time of the encounter in a way that does not depend upon the notion of presence. I think I just read recently somebody who edited that. The book that this piece on global modernity and contemporaries in, has written a really long kind of Derridian critique of Fabian.
Claiming, do you have a reference? Who was that?
This guy, Burger de Vermage. He's Dutch.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay.
Yeah. On the grounds that. That there's a secret metaphysics of presence in the logic of the coeval. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's very unhappy because he sent it to Fabian. So.
he
didn't get the intellectual engagement he was looking for, so he sent it to me instead. I just told him I thought he was wrong. I can see how that might happen. I can see how you might want to read Fabian like that. But I think that what's productive about Fabian is that it isn't. I would like to avoid all the post-Heideggerian discussions about presence, really. So I don't think it. I mean, as I say, it is a danger. It's provoked by the fact that there's something about the contemporary which prioritizes the present as in relation to these three temporal ecstasies, right? Because it prioritizes, if you like, the lateral moment of encounter.
Yeah, I guess with Fabian, the idea that what is shared time? It's really, mean, if we're not talking about shared presence.
Well, I mean, it's difficult because it seems in the Fabians, if you have two ways of interpreting this, you could go down the presence route, which I think is dangerous because it negates the whole critique. Because it ends up in a way being a way into some kind of metaphysical presence. You know, it becomes a quickly ontologized discourse. Or you end up in a kind of a way that takes you more towards the philosophy of religion, which is a kind of intensely invested ephemerality of each experience, right? That at each moment of the encounter is its own authentic production of time, which exists only in that moment and is
the straight gate through which
can enter. Yeah, in a way that everything, you know. But I think that's a consequence of Fabian, you know, ending up with this purely anthropological space, alternative anthropological space without any history, because of his association of history with developmentalism. Because in a way that in this literature there's been two problems historically. One is people associating history with historicism. So not in a way having enough space for alternative conceptions of history. Because they simply think, because of the disciplinary character of history, that the kind of chronologism of historicism is history. So there's no philosophical space. And Deleuze, for example, Deleuze seems to deny this, but it seems obviously true, has no concept of history, because the whole point of Deleuze is philosophical argument about time is to displace history by becoming. Okay, so becoming becomes the concept which displaces history. But that's because the signifier history is tied to the discipline of history and the form of chronological time and the forms of periodization and stagism which historians do. But the alternative, there's an equal problem, which is a parallel to that, which is associating history with a developmentalist theory, or the kind of modernization version of history, or some version of progress, so that the critique of that also becomes the critique of history, which is what you're getting. Get in Fabian. So the difficulty is to what I'm trying to do is keep open the space of a philosophical concept of history, right? But the content of which is itself historical. In other words, not a philosophically self-sufficient concept of history, but a philosophical concept of history, which is a philosophical interpretation of the present. Right? So that the philosophy is not a self-sufficient discourse here. It's a form of interpretation, if you like, of the highest level of it. It's interpretation of the highest level of abstraction, or the highest level of unity.
So what do you make of Anker Smith's idea of sublime historical experience, where we have these...
I don't know that. Who's this?
F.R. Anker Smith. He says that he's a Dutch historian, and he says we have these brief, and they're not planned for ruptures of or moments where we are in direct contact with the past. So he says that this direct contact is pre-reflective, in much like an aesthetic experience, and he borrows from the notion of pragmatic aesthetic experience here. But basically he says that this is what some historians like Huizinga have used.
I don't know this, I can't really comment on it. It sounds like I would be dubious about it, but
he says he's unapologetically, he says it's a romantic view of that. We are in touch with feelings and emotions and moods rather than that's the first.
But how does that level work at the level of world history?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he would say that this comes through certain experiences of, say, art. So Goethe's in Italy, and he has some certain flashback or encounter with the past that says that he.
So it's not going to hack it for me at the level of world history, Goethe in Italy, I don't think.
Yeah, well, sure.
But I mean, I think that's the... Yeah.
This question of history is really important and interesting. Yesterday you said, focusing on... I don't remember what the first part of your statement was, but, you know, focusing on these issues, kind of temporal structures, thinking philosophically about time and temporality is not an alternative to history, but allows for and requires a different understanding of the relationship between past and present than you get in disciplinary history. And I think that's absolutely crucial. And I think that's part of what's so exciting about your work, not just for philosophers or people trying to grasp the temporal dimensions of globalization, but as a kind of I know this isn't your project, but some of us are concerned with, as a kind of intervention into the space of historiography, to open up the possibility of actually not doing this kind of work, but using this kind of work to then open up the space to do a different kind of, to engage history differently as an explanation of the present, for example, but through historical material. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities that open up.
That's the idea, because that was the point about explaining, in other words, what's the status of these categories?
Mm-hmm.
They're not philosophical. What is the status of these large-scale categories like modernity, global modernity, contemporary? They're not philosophical concepts in the sense that they're not conceptually self-sufficient. You can't legitimate them through pure philosophical discourses. Right?
They're worldly.
They're not empirical concepts in the sense that they're not constructed. Or whatever, but they are transdisciplinary concepts. In other words, they function at a certain level of theoretical generality, which is the level of generality that used to be occupied by self-sufficient philosophy. Mm-hmm. In a way, this is just, in the famous paragraph on the Critique of Philosophy and the German Ideology, where Marx raises the question about, well, what happens after philosophy? He says self-sufficient philosophy will be replaced by the summing up of the results of the positive sciences. Right? That's the famous sentence. And that's the space. But the problem is that is a methodologically naive description of how to occupy that conceptual space and summing up results, if you like. But it is partly that, because in a way, the way that the Politics of Time as a book worked, and the way this essay works, the one on global modernity and the contemporary, is to take concepts which have been constituted in social and cultural theory with relatively long histories, to imminently critique the debates about the structure of those concepts, and then to reconstruct and further generalize those concepts in a way that they can function more critically and more generally within the discourses from which they've in a way been appropriated. So it's a kind of philosophy as critique, in the sense that you produce a level of philosophical universality, but not through any self-sufficiency.
But it's not genealogy either, which is interesting, right?
It's not genealogy, but there is a genealogical dimension, because it depends upon the history of the construction of these concepts in their respective disciplines, but particularly it depends on, this is where the Gezellig thing comes. It depends to a certain extent on the use of historical semantics to produce a greater level of generality in concept construction, a greater self-consciousness about the generality of concept construction than is deployed in the concept construction within those disciplines themselves, because historical semantics gives you a much longer term temporality. So there's lots of problems with Gezellig, but the idea of historical semantics and the way that historical semantics might function in concept construction are completely accepted. I don't accept the way Gezellig necessarily does it. And the whole Cassan book in a way is an alternative to the Gezellig methodology. It's like
Which book?
The Cassan vocabulary we talked about.
It's
a different, it's a philologically as opposed to a conceptually based semantic history. So that's a methodological issue. And what Balibar, Cassan and de Libera showed in relation to their history of the concept of the subject, but particularly in these three volumes by de Libera, is that you really can conceptually conceptually reconstruct things on the basis of philological histories in a way which is a different kind of thing from Gezellig. Because Gezellig has no critical philological aspect methodologically. He's moving very quickly from semantics to concept, and he's using own economical taxes.
Okay, this might be simplistic, but I'm thinking of like...
No. Keep going. I was going to shift things a little.
Okay, well, let me just in this thing, in terms of this as an intervention into history, it seems like one way is to expand and run with this idea of concept history in a deeper way, or in a kind of, you know, like focusing on...
Well, see, I'm not going to call it history. I'm going to call it historical semantics as material conceptual construction.
Historical semantics.
So it's not conceptual history. It's
no problem.
Semantic history.
Semantic history. But that's one way in which this could be a kind of way back into history. But another would be, in a very simplistic way, like producing histories of temporal structures, like historians attending, even the whole idea of afterlife, the afterlife as a structure that disciplinary history can't grasp as a social fact, but is a social fact and has. I mean, I think your work kind of suggests one way into that, and read together, I think that's so. Concept or history of semantics is one way to kind of. So I'm just very interested in this idea of taking some of your insights about saying, look, we can't have, in the politics of time, I think you say something like, we can't have a materialist conception of history unless we attend to time structures. And I want to kind of take that idea seriously as a historian and not just as a kind of thinker or theorist.
It's quite difficult because, I mean, there's a whole journal. I mean, I'm on the editorial, whatever, of it. It's been going for about 20 years now, called Time and Society. Just publishes articles on this stuff. But what's interesting about it is that the discourse in the journal is completely split and reproduces the existing academic division of labor. So what you get are numerous amounts of empirical studies. I mean, most of each issue of the journal, you know, is five or six empirical studies, which are all interesting, you know, in their own way, depending on what your interests are, which are, you know, in a way, they're not intended to be, but kind of partly quasi-ethno-methodological, you know, in other words, the experience of time in, and then some social practice, you know, in a sewing factory in the Philippines in 1940 or something, you know, I mean, they're case studies like that. They're interesting, but it's all like that. It's all empirical, and it's done at the level, in a way it's all kind of unconsciously Husserlian, because it's all about time consciousness. So time is registered here empirically as time consciousness. And time consciousness is recovered by interviewing people about their time consciousness. And then combining that with the quantitative empirical material about the rhythms of their working day and the way that they're working spin up, etc. And then with very occasional, like theoretical articles about time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that despite the fact that the journal is aware of, because it's reviewed, you know, large amounts of theoretical material about time, none of the empirical studies are in any way informed by any of this theoretical material.
No doubt it's different. That's why it's so exciting to me. It's like, what would that look like? How do we do that?
I mean, it's not bad. I'm not objecting to it, but it's kind of disappointing. Because you get nothing comes out of it.
Don't forget your thought, Kristen.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think Kozelnik allows us to understand the singularization of the concept of history and the acceleration of the concept of history, end of the 18th century, according to Kozelnik.
Yeah.
But I think we have another question. And I think our question is more deeper. Is the concept of time, which is presupposed in the Kozelnik's representation of the possibility of acceleration and singularization. And that means is that our question is that it regards the temporalization of time, and I think the temporalization of time becomes a problem at the beginning of modernity, when you destroy the old ontological and theological order. In Aristotle and in Plato, the temporalization doesn't exist; it's not a problem. You have an ontological order, and you have just to count an order which already exists. In Hobbes, it's very interesting, you have the opposite. By counting 1, 2, 3, 4, you produce order. and you produce the order of time. So the subject becomes the producer of time. And then you have a different attempt in the modernity. And very nice in Hobbes, you have the destruction of the ontology, new kind of temporalization, at the same time, destruction of the ontological order, a new political form, the modern political form. And I think the two things, I don't know how, but the two things go together. And we have to think modern political form and the temporalization of time together. I don't know how. I'm working about it. But I think we need to think together these two things. And then you have, in modernity, different attempts to temporalize time. You have Kant, through the pure form, condition of possibility of experience, universal experience, Newtonian absolute time. And then you have Heidegger, in my opinion, who temporalized time, but through the ontologization of the Dasein. This is my criticism to Heidegger. I think Heidegger needs to ontologize the Dasein in order to temporalize time. And then you have maybe Marx, our previous discussion, the process of valorization value. This is the dominant temporality in the structure. And then you have Benjamin. You have different attempts of temporalized time. The problem is, which kind of temporalization do we need? First question. Because they are not my question. The different kind of temporalization, they are not innocent.
Yes,
they are not innocent.
Yeah.
Heidegger has consequences. Marx has consequences. Yeah. Benjamin has consequences. Yeah. They are not innocent. And then we have in modernity now, in our time, I think we have still ontological representation of time in different cultures. I think this is a question of anthropology, but I am pretty ignorant, but I know that you have a different representation of time in different cultures, which works with an ontological representation of time. That means our problem, the problem of temporalization, is only our modern European problem, maybe, or maybe the problem of a culture which destroyed any ontological representation of time. I don't want to come back to an ontology.
It may have a European origin, but it's not a European problem. It's, now that it's connected to the temporality of valorization, it's everybody's problem, right?
Yes, but...
Right? I mean, this is the problem with these, spatializations of these issues.
So and so's conception of time.
Europe, yeah. West, etc. That doesn't grasp the spatial generalizations of these logics, and it doesn't grasp them. It increasingly starts to look sentimental.
But I think we have one temporality is the temporality of capital, universal temporality, but. I think this is the topic of Chakrabarty. Therefore, Chakrabarty introduced History 1, History 2. And you have a conflict between...
Catastrophically analytical terminology, yes.
Yeah.
And therefore you have the History 1, the history of capital and the temporality of capital, but at the same time you have counter-temporalities or different histories. That means community, traditions, and these kind of things, and counter-temporality, even struggles, movement, they interact with the history one. And the interaction between the two histories produces history.
Yeah.
But you...
Yeah, but that's fine, except on that model, dialectically, history two is wholly internal to history one. That's the problem.
It's only internal. No, I don't know.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, that's the problem with it.
That's the problem.
He separates them out.
Yeah,
because he wants to have it both ways.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he wants subaltern history and he wants the other history. He wants them to be the same history. Yeah. He has to make a decision.
Is it useful to go back to Lefebvre at all? And everyday life and that whole question or that whole concept of modernity and how you're
trying to... You see, I don't think it is because I think... since I was meant to write something about this, I was unable to, so I wrote something else instead when I went to a conference. Which is, if you like, what is the current status of the concept of everyday life as a, you know, as this kind of internally oppositional concept? And I'm not saying.
Well, I don't know if it's opposition.
I'm not saying because in a way it's already there in Lefebvre, because Lefebvre is fairly ambivalent, right? It's like fairly structurally ambivalent about this. But I mean, the side of Lefebvre, the aspect of Lefebvre where everyday life, you know, has been appropriated, that seems to be the what is intensified historically, as opposed to the kind of slight, you know, this what now looks increasingly starts to begin to look a bit romantic about his concept of everyday life
is what?
Well, is its kind of residual authenticity. The sense that it's constituted negative by that which is not X, Y, and Z.
I was thinking about it when you two were talking about these counter temporalities that are generated by capital, and then you were saying you were trying to have it both ways too, because you were saying that you had to think the counter temporalities both as not dialectically produced within capital and as outside of capital, right?
But at that point, what I wanted to ask you was
really for an example of what you meant by one of these counter temporalities. At what level are you speaking?
Well, for example, if you think of Tronti's stuff, or, you know, stuff about the labor movement in the 70s, think about the argument that, you know, that labor organization, okay, which has an externality, yeah, it's a counter temporality, the temporality of the strike, for example. Take the temporality of the strike. That's a counter temporality of your model, yeah? And it seems to be, you know, fulfill all the criteria for counter temporality. But what happens at the point, the problem for Tronti is what happens when Tronti realizes that, in a way, that the logic of the strike, if you like, ends up being, if you like, systemic in the reorganization of accumulation and the further development of the value form because of the effect of the strike on, you know, the distinction between relative and surplus value, etc., right? So that you get reach the point of the argument where capital won't develop if there aren't any strikes. Reach that point in the argument. Then, if you like, you can produce a narrative, at least, which re-inscribes the temporality of the strike into the systemic as a moment in the systemic temporality of capital. But that's a retroactive thing. But then all of these historical accounts are, if you like, ontologically retroactive. Right? I mean, things turn out to have been not what they were.
Right, so it's just the old recuperation argument. But then you have to ask the sort of Leninist question of for whom is it a counter temporality? Right?
That's right, yeah. Well, to begin with, it's a counter temporality for everybody. But it remains a counter temporality for everyone because on this argument, you know, Because its functionality for capital works at the level of capital in general, it nonetheless works against every particular capital. Right? So no capital will embrace the functional temporality of the strike for capital in general because it's against the interests of each particular capital. So, you know, even if even if the capitalist class were made theoretically aware of the capital productivity of strikes, it wouldn't be in the interest of any particular capital to encourage strikes, because they're in a competitive relation with other capitals, right? So this is the whole problem about subject position, and then the subject position of capital in general, which is not inhabited. I mean, historically that problem was solved by Marx, because the state was the representative of capital in general, right, against particular capitals, and then it turned out that the state was representative of, well, at least national capitals, etc. And then you've got that. But that's one of the problematics. The denationalisation of capital markets has kind of eroded, and the embrace by governments of the idea that they have to, if you like, support capital in general, even when it's against their national interests. Bizarrely, because in some metaphysical way it's in their national interest, because it's to do with capital, which is the bizarre situation currently, right? Where everyone does what capital wants, even when it's against their interests, because they're kind of, in some metaphysical way, scared that something terrible will happen if they don't. I don't really understand the way that's working.
But could you come back for a second to your thought about everyday life? What about it might kind of be useful to kind of go back to in terms of...
Well, it was kind of a question. Peter and I met like 30 years ago at a conference about everyday life, and it was... And I think it would be interesting for you to write that article. Yeah.
So specifically in terms of counter-temporalities?
Well, he does have that business at the very end of, say, the production of space or something where he has... Or, there is this kind of... you're right. I mean, what he traces is this increasing homogenization, fragmentation, hierarchy, and all of that. And that keeps getting more and more increased as we move into, the present moment. But there is always, at some point, and this, you might say that this is part of developmentalism or something, but there is something that he calls, what is it, differential space? Differential space, which is in fact a counter-temporality.
Yeah, but I think I have a little critique of this concept of differential space in the chapter on space in this book, which is the first chapter. Mm-hmm. But because I think the relationship, I don't like his own. I mean, in a way, I agree with him, but I don't like the way I think he's wrong in the way he expands the relation between differential space and abstract space, which is what's at issue, in a way. I'd have to go. I read that a while ago. I'd have to go and read what I wrote.
So it's about a different kind of lived time, a different.
Yeah, I mean, I continue to find him kind of interesting because he does sort of operate at all of the different levels, he operates at the level of, pure structural abstraction and...
But see, I think there's a tendency...
Yeah, lived and representation.
There's a tendency for him to identify, if you like, the abstract with the homogeneous and the capital, etc., and the differential with the concrete and the...
Which is what Depeche says too. Yeah. Exactly that.
Whereas it seems to me that you can't distribute abstract categories like abstract and differential in that way. But now that there's something that these general systemic logics are themselves so profoundly differentiating, and so profoundly productive of differentials, that opposition is a problem. But it's not clear what the consequences of that. Like theoretical critique is for the question of everyday life.
But does our conversation here change if we talk about rhythm instead of some of the words we've been using?
I don't know if it does. I mean, there's a fundamental, there's a theoretical position which would, the kind of Hart and Negri position, in a way, or the more extreme version of it, the Deleuzian. Sort of non-economic, Deleuzian economic position completely destroys the content of everyday life. Because post-Negrian arguments based on Negri's, in my view, erroneous critique of the labour theory of value mean that for those people, like all activities are equally economically productive.
Right.
Yeah. Now, if all social activities are equally economically productive, then you don't have a distinction, or you don't have everyday life anymore. It's been abolished.
You also don't have labor.
You know, well, because
the material
everything is,
labor,
you know,
yeah.
Everything is, but I mean, I think this is economic nonsense, right, which doesn't allow you to understand anything, but it reflects a tendency. I mean, one of the things that they're getting at is this capacity for this social system to refunctionalize things in various ways. I mean, the mistake with that argument is that it wants to make them all productive of value. Although it's unclear that how you can have a concept of value once you've so I think that's economically confused, but they're in advanced capitalist economies, it's a terrible phrase, isn't it? I mean, in the most productive capitalist economies, the relations between life and work time have changed profoundly.
Since the 19th century,
yeah.
Yeah, so they're considering rhythms of life have changed profoundly.
Yeah, you could say rhythms, but I don't know.
And that production is a form of rhythm.
But it's the differentiation. I mean, sociiologically, you know, this is what the sociologists call de-differentiation. For the sociologists, de-differentiation is the principal category for what they call second modernity.
What does that mean, de-differentiation?
Well, I mean, basically, people, you know, systems theorists like Luhmann and people, you know, think of modernity as a social system based on functional differentiation and the creation of subsystems. That's what the sort of thing that Habermas takes over.
State society.
These different subsystems. Life world, in a way, is the place within systems theory where everyday life is located. Mm-hmm. and then they see the first, you know, the most recent developments in the last 50 years in terms of, well, there was a debate about whether it was post-modernity. They come to this idea that they use these terms, late modernity, second modernity, super modernity, hyper modernity. There's all these different phrases. But for the system theorists, the principal that governs the distinction between first and second modernity is a move from differentiation to de-differentiation. And de-differentiation is where, if you like, a dominant subsystem de-differentiates in order to more functionally appropriate other subsystems. It's all very, you know, this is systems theory, right? it's all very abstract, but it does grasp in a way. You know, it's what human resources departments call the work-life balance, laughably. Right? The idea that there is such a thing as a work-life balance, and the idea that that's work, which is not life, which is kind of that. But, you know, because I mean, if you think, you know, think in the way, I mean, academics are particularly, this is true for, I mean, can you differentiate working from non-working time?
I think
you know, we are the... We are the biggest self-exploiters here, right?
Jennifer, did you? Oh, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, very briefly. I think in Marx you can find, actually, we can agree, we can disagree with Marx, it's not a problem, but you can find an attempt to overcome the abstract representation of time. And when Marx wrote that capital is the automatic subject, this is the point of view of the circulation. It's before chapter 7. And chapter 7 is the beginning of the production. What is the valorization process and the process of advice process, or the working process, and then you have the rest of capital. This is the first seven chapters.
No,
then you have other 20 chapters, history, and what happens in the production.
No, but then chapter 6 of volume 1 then links up with volume 3 and essentially continues into the stuff on credit in volume 3, where the phrase automatic subject reappears.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes, but in the same chapter, that is a very philological discussion. Okay, no, I don't want make any philological discussion. Okay, in the chapter 6, I think you have the change.
I've been teaching this.
Yeah. I mean, you can find a very nice changing of a perspective from circulation, beginning of chapter 6, to production. We have to go into the working place of the production, and then you have the after chapter six you have the description, the representation of what is happening in the production. And what is happening, I think, when Marx describes the production as the a place with the torturous machines, I think it's not for a moral question. This is the reason why it is, because Marx tried to represent how the abstract time of capital destroys the real time of life of human being. And then, second, destroy their body. And this is the absolutely unjust moment of the capitalist production. I sell you my force of labor, but because I have to come with my body in the production, you are destroying, you capital are destroying my body, and you are using my body. This is not fair. Because by distracting my body, you are distracting my time, my time for reproducing myself, etc. And this is the concrete moment. And therefore, I think, according to Marx, this is the advantage point of view for considering the temporality of capital. You have, if you want to break the abstract temporality of capital, you have to consider what is happening in the laboratory of the production, in the working place of the production. And then...
Yeah, but that's...
That's why he puts the chapter on the working day in. And that's why that's such a big breakthrough, that decision to do that.
Yeah.
Because that changes his entire notion of what theory is.
Yes, yes, I agree, absolutely, yes, yes, yes.
But theoretically what it does is it grounds, it grounds the grounding of value in time, in mortality. So it gives you, if you like, an argument for... You know, because all the a lot of those arguments about the labour theory of value, you know, well, where does it come from? Where does the category of time, you know, it just comes out of his back pocket, and it's a real sort of Kantian argument, and there is nothing else but suddenly, you know, yeah, I've taken this from somewhere, and I'm just going to say, you know, there is nothing else that it could be but this, you know, it's absolutely no argument, you know, and so then you have all these people arguing about, well, what is the legitimation for it, and they do this quantitatively, etc.
Yeah.
But actually, the legitimation is in this later stuff. The legitimation is in the fact that time is the value of life, right? I mean, but that's why, you know, although I completely disagree with Nehru's critique of the labour theory of value,
yeah,
his account of, if you like, the relationship between time and communism in time for revolution, it's good.
Yeah. But, yes, I think you have the theory of Nehru is the theory, you can say, is a strategy for the revolution from the point of view of circulation. That means you can avoid the theory of value, and you can say that everything, every form of activity produces value.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, every form of struggle, movement, protest, is in itself potentially revolutionary.
But that would work if you just replaced the term value with wealth.
But you lost, this is what the Nehru did, you lost any criteria of differentiation.
Yeah, no, exactly. Of course.
Otherwise, in Marx, you have a criteria. Yeah, you have to consider what is happening in the production.
Because Nehru is trying to view the present from the standpoint of a categorical situation which is realized only in communism, right?
Yeah.
So he's prefiguratively assuming that you can do that, right? And if you do that, you end up with Werner and the capitalism, the communism of capital, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you may as well declare capitalism communism at this point.
Other thoughts?
But this is once again a question of a criteria. Really? In Marx, this is a criteria. You have to consider the different temporalities, circulation, reproduction, everything from the point of view of production. Because production is it's not because it's production of commodities. No, I don't believe this. Because it's a relation. It's the relationship between human being, workers, and capital. And capital is, during the process of valorization, capital is destroying the body, the life, the time of the workers, of the human being. And then you have to consider the machine, everything what is engaged in the production, with an intrinsic capitalist use of value. Machines are not neutral. Computers are not neutral. Technology is not neutral. Science is not neutral. Everything is engaged in the production, and you have to consider everything from the point of view of the production. That means from the point of view of the life and body of the concrete workers. But this is a criteria of differentiation. That means, because from this point of view, we can disagree. But from this point of view, you cannot say that every protest or movement are important in the same way, in the same form. You have to try to make such a differentiation between what is happening in the civil society, a word that I don't like very much.
So you're suggesting that everyday life can be a standpoint of critique?
Yeah. Yeah.
And not just a kind of romantic fantasy of a space that is outside of capital.
Yeah. What is
I think so.
There?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, how do you delimit it? Because the problem in Lefebvre is always to do with the delimitation, because it's defined negatively and also kind of serially negatively again, so that there's more than one, if you like, negative construction. As those oppositions get broken down, it seems to, if you like, shrink as a category. But does that make sense, if you see what I mean? Is it the sort of thing that can shrink? I mean, is it the sort of thing that can shrink? Because the reason that
in his view, it gets increasingly colonized, right?
Yes. Yeah. But is a colonized everyday life anymore? Or is it? You see what I mean?
But it's an interesting metaphor. It is kind of.
But this is exactly the same, unfortunately, as Habermas's, colonization of the life world by the system is the same metaphor. It's the only place colonization gets into Habermas.
So, once again, we're back to politics and time. Right? Politics and time in the. I guess I don't want to repeat the conversations of yesterday about politics and contemporaneity, but it does strike me that, a lot of people in the room were very interested in the political possibilities opened up by this understanding of not flat coevalness, but kind of multiplicity of articulated temporalities at the same time. And I know in Politics of Time you said, look, insofar as these temporal structures are kind of products of social practices, they're also, potential objects of transformative practice.
Yeah.
And I guess I wonder if you've thought about kind of carrying that insight forward into this your reflections on the contemporary.
Yeah, well,
not just as the place where images freeze time or time is annihilated or the fiction of co-presence, but as opening up a way maybe beyond the kind of whether it's the dominant logic of valorization or whether it's the kind of the epistemology of historicism or developmental logic of modern. I mean, there are all kinds of very interesting conceptual and political possibilities that come with recognizing in a very real way or insisting on the co-presence, which isn't just about kind of cultural relativism or something, right? It's not just the Fabian move. There seems to be something very interesting.
Yeah, I think there is, but I don't think you can. But it's a change in the terrain of social temporality, and so that's, if you like, a change in the terrain of political struggle and the shape of the practices around which you're going to struggle and the shape of the. But you can't.
So say a little bit more about that. What's different about the terrain and what becomes either the objects or methods of struggle in this new terrain?
You can't derive political prescriptions from discourse is this abstract. This goes back to the argument yesterday. Okay, I mean, you have to say that.
I'm not asking for political.
If you like, rethink the temporal terms of the terrain in a very broad way. Yeah. So that we then, if you like, have to try and think about particular practices, you know, in relation to that kind of temporalizing scenario. But you'd have to start with those practices, not to start here and kind of try and get a political answer from the theory. I don't believe in that. I mean, you have to start with the practices and think, you know, how does a framework of temporalization like this help us think about
the practices that we're engaged in? That's exactly what I'm asking.
You have to do it the other way around.
So you start with something like the chronotope of the encampment.
Well, you could do, But if you do that,
or the you end up with
an analysis called cynical occupy. But but that was one attempt. So we should actually have argued about that piece, really, probably.
Can I ask
a
question? Yeah. So this brings me back to a question I had yesterday, which was observing contemporaneity constructed in art and the fictionalization and the collectivization. I guess the question I had was, can those be emulated politically usefully in Occupy, in...
What do you mean by emulated?
I mean, can those practices of producing art also be practices of producing politics?
So I don't know, see, I... I'm kind of against that. I mean, part of the... You know, there's a strong side to kind of art activism, which is precisely that. I mean, Gerald Rannick or somebody like this, right? You know, who in a way wants to produce an indifference between art activism and political activism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wants to think of that as, if you like, a single space. Right. But I think that what is called art in the society in which we live is a massively over-institutionalized phenomenon, and it's constituted institutionally in a way which for me makes you think that one can naively ignore, if you like, its institutional determinations and things. So, I mean, I can think of various things that people think themselves as our activists do politically, if you like, that function politically.
Right.
And but I'm just happy to think of this as an imaginative kind of politics. I don't know why we would need to think about it as art at the time in which it's being done as politics. Because what will happen to it historically is, under certain conditions and depending what kind of thing it is and how many people secretly take home the documentation and stash it for 20 years and then flog it 20 years later, it will institutionally become art in its documented form. You know, but that's just, if you like, a sad residue of political practices. I mean, I would just try and think of it as politics.
I don't mean art as activism.
Yeah.
I mean the way you talked about how you see contemporaneity expressed in art through these mechanisms. So not those artists being political, but those techniques as a way to engage a reality of contemporaneity.
I mean, there's a criterion. I mean, going back to, I have a criterion for you. There's a criteriological moment here. Because I want this, see, the point about this concept of the contemporary is it's supposed to function in the art context, and the same could be, in the political context, which is your question, I guess. It's supposed to function critically as a criterion, if you like, for the contemporaneity of a practice. Right? So, and it's supposed to function critically in the sense in which criteria like that that function critically are supposed to exclude the vast majority of things as failing to meet the criteria. But the point is that in art, there's a, because of the social function of art, it seems to me there is a value, if you like, in the critical criteria of contemporaneity. Yeah. Because it's the criteria of historical meaning. Right. It's a criteria that a work has to make to, if you like, be a work which has, if you like, is a significant articulation of the historical present. Because, if you like, that's one of, because what's underlying the criteria of the art here is that art is valuable and interesting when it, if you like, articulates the historical present in a way, a new way of significance and draws attention to new forms of significance in formal ways, etc. The question is contemporaneity a criterion? Should it be a criterion in politics? Or need it be a criterion in politics? It's not clear to me. Well, first, it's not clear to me if that question makes sense. Secondly, it's not clear to me that if it makes sense, that the answer is necessarily yes.
Well, not necessarily if what you mean is like the ability to express the new. But yesterday you did talk.
No, it's more than
you
that.
Did
that,
talk
would
about
modern, that would be modern.
You talked about or the historical present, not the new, the historical present. But yesterday you did talk about art in a way that seemed very productive. Like you could put the term politics in when you said, what's interesting about art with respect to contemporaneity is it's the place or the scene or the set of practices where the question of these, the multiplicity of temporalities is most present, most at stake. That's what it's about in a certain way. And in that respect, it seemed like not that art activists could be a way to do a new kind of politics, but that you're thinking about art with respect to time could be very useful for thinking about what's political about politics.
Yeah, it could be, but not by virtue of transposing the art.
No, not at all.
But I think transposing the... See, one of the saddest things about Occupy Wall Street, for me, was the way that it was immediately appropriated by art activists and then taken into institutional, mainstream institutional sites. And these are people I would politically take very seriously before this happened. As something which was completely nothing to do with institutions, absolutely pure politics, completely counter-institutional, right? Without any sense that the fact that they were doing it at the Berlin Biennale didn't completely negate the argument they were making about the fact that it had nothing to do with art, it was completely counter-institutional, etc. Right? And that just seemed to me, I don't know whether it was because particular artists saw their world historical career moment and couldn't. Grasp it, but the point is that dynamic became very quickly a part of the social meaning of.
You're just suggesting yesterday in a very nice way though that art becomes a place to see certain temporal dynamics and to see the way in which temporal dynamics can be kind of reworked.
I'm going to talk about this. That's because it's not politics. That's because of the autonomization of the space. So all of the things that, if you like, are bad, inverted commas, about the autonomy of art are the condition for these things. And they go away if you conflate them with politics.
But what if you say that art as a thing gathers multiplicities of
time? I think you have to first and foremost think of art institutionally as a production of certain sets of institutional conditions for the possibility of certain kinds of presentation of certain kind of practices. I don't think you can
but there's a lot of
carry a philosophical, you know, a general notion of art around as a practice you can just do anywhere or whatever. I mean, that's what the way a lot of artists, and particularly the way, extremely irritatingly to me, a lot of my students who are artists like to think, you know, they are artists, that, you know, so they carry art wherever they are. So whatever they do, then there is, you know, there is art doing going on. I mean, you know, that may be, you know, that's the fault of the art school, that's right.
In that case, though, there's a lot of artists, but they may not be bad at having gone.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Yeah, I'm sure there are. Yeah. But for me, the fact that they're artists doesn't really matter. It's, in other words, it's why is it different to what they're doing politically that they're artists?
Then why are you putting all this energy into thinking through art in relation to the contemporary, for example? Well, there must be more than just
because it has a critical... I don't want to make political claims for art, because I'm an adornment about art. Right? I think, you know, the productivity, cognitive productivity, experiential productivity of art is bought at the cost of impotence, at the cost of its separation from politics. I mean, the problem with the Dorian was he thought there was no politics, so he was just left with the art. Okay, but the politics is something else.
But just like with Casella, why not go back to that, reclaim it, and not in a kind of simplistic, instrumental way, but there's something about art, aesthetic practices, that fictional or semi-autonomy that interests you, that fascinates you, that you're saying warrants our attention as a peculiar kind of social, you know, aspect of society or set of practices that where we can see certain things and do certain things. And it seems to me that...
That's because the institutional history of modernism is such that it's the place where practices which are self-consciously reflective about temporality and historical temporalities and the construction of temporalities through practices are played out on a very good day.
But it seems to me that, like, in the best way, that could be a charter or an opening for thinking about politics or rethinking politics or...
But why start from rethinking politics from art? Why not...
Not rethinking politics from art, but seeing the way I read your paper was that art expresses that we can see in art a change that's already happened. That we can.
Is this talking about the first chapter?
That art. Here's an example in the world of this concept of contemporaneity that I've been trying to articulate and the way in which it's in tension with modern temporality. Right. So it's not a source. It's an example that by viewing it just highlights, I think, the truth of these two temporalities that are in competition. And in seeing it in that way, it offers a possibility to say, okay, so there's this part of the stuckness we've been feeling is because there's this new temporal structure that it's just as an example, not as a means. And so some of the techniques of expressing that art are perhaps a means, but not necessarily art creating politics, because I totally take that point and agree.
I think I agree with that.
Okay. that's okay.
That could be a very nice ending point. Although, you know, talk more about art. No, thank you,
Kristen.
Peter
will tell us more about the everyday.
Peter, thank you so much. I know
Kristen should write this paper.
You guys have to co-write it. It would be a dollar. But thank you so much for the visit and taking the time and being patient with questions and challenges. And I apologize for the kind of difficulty of the natural conditions, the bigger rhythms, and disaster, the difficulty of bringing people, but it was extremely rich and useful for all of us, really. Thank you very much.
Just going to get Max to write down the title of his book. So.